God, sometime in the past, developed a 7,000-year plan for mankind, and he allotted the first 1,000 years, first 6,000 years for man, and I think the purpose was to prove that he really couldn't govern himself, and then he had the 1,000 years at the end, the millennium, so that God can show us how it truly can be done. And the Bible tells us when God created the earth and that the angels shouted for joy. So probably seeing this universe, I mean, it's big, but it's contained in the sense that it's physical, and anything physical has limits. And God says he knows all the stars by name, so obviously, or by number too, so there's a limited amount. But they were joyful about it. Of course, at that point in time, they understood God's plan. And God chose to make us physical because we have a proving ground, because it's easier to deal with that than if he created us spirit, like, you know, the angels, and all of a sudden he has rebellion on his hands. It'd be a real issue. But by creating us physical, we have to prove that we want that spiritual life by our fruits. And right from the get-go, Satan got in there, and of course, sin entered the world, and it didn't take long, you know. There was murder involved with the first Adam and Eve's first children. And then with Satan influencing mankind, I mean, you had just... the world became totally corrupt to the point where, except for Noah and his family, God had to destroy mankind. And, you know, it's like resetting the clock in a sense, and then things move forward from there. And, of course, I covered in my first sermon, Matthew 24 basically outlines the end time events, and we've covered some of that with deception in the church and persecution and wars and rumors of wars, and these things are increasing in intensity and frequency, and earthquakes and that, especially as we get to the last, you know, the last days, which we are in now. But of course, we don't set dates, and we don't know how long it's going to go, but we know that it's not going to go on forever. There's reaching a point where mankind will destroy himself, all flesh, if Christ would not intervene. That's how bad it's going to get. And my first sermon talked about conditions leading up to the return of Christ, and also how Christ will return. And I looked at possible scenario outlining that. But for us, that's the crucial moment in our life. In other words, if we're alive, that's what we've been waiting for, the time of our transition from physical to spirit, where we live forever. I mean, you know, it's kind of hard to put your mind on that. I mean, when you talk about, it's hard to, when you think backwards, it's easy to say, okay, I can foresee living forever going forward, but God's been around forever. It's hard to picture in your mind's eye how he could have existed in the past forever. Like, you know, it's a really hard concept to understand, but that future, that living in God's kingdom, is what lies ahead of us. So today I want to look at the millennium, that thousand-year period, and discuss basically three areas: the challenges facing us at the beginning, and secondly, the conditions that are going to be prevalent, and then what needs to be accomplished by the end of the millennium. So my first point is the challenges facing us at the beginning. Well, by the time Christ sets foot on earth, the earth is really a mess. Every single city on earth is a pile of rubble. People are going to be scared, starving, and they're going to need, a lot of them are going to need shelter. And if you'd like to turn to Revelation 16, describe some of the conditions that we're going to see on the earth at that particular time. In Revelation 16, and beginning in verse 17, it says, "Then the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne, saying, "It is done." And there were noises and thunderings and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such a mighty and great earthquake as had not occurred since men were on the earth. So this is a magnitude that we can hardly put your mind around, because it's never occurred before. "Now the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell." Every major city on the earth is just going to crumble. Like the two towers at New York when those planes hit them. That type of scenario. Every city. "And great Babylon was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. And every island fled away, and the mountains were not found." So some of the events that are on the earth, you know, God has to be involved in them. We're not involved in that. I mean, you know, every island fled away. Possibly the positioning of the continents, you know, so that we're one landmass. Things of that nature. God has to do that. We're not involved in that, because those are things that we just don't have the capabilities. And the mountains, it appears like there'll be mountains, because it says Mount Zion will be the highest point, but they're not going to be, it appears that they're going to be as high as they are today. So there's going to be great changes in the land, so that it'll be, you know, you need a lot more land to cultivate the needs that are going to be there. But the basic needs of an individual, I mean, the very basic needs are food, water, clothing, and shelter. Those are basic needs. And once these needs are filled and you feel safe, you feel like you're safe, you know, a safe environment, then you can branch out and do good deeds and serve others and grow in grace and knowledge. I mean, if a person's half starving to death, you can't go up to him with the Bible and then start preaching to him. It's just not going to sink in. He's worried about getting food in his stomach. But once you satisfy those needs, then you can start working with them, directing them towards God, you know. And if your whole day as an individual is just providing food for your family, there's just not room for any other kind of growth. It's impossible. And that's just a basic fact. So right from the onset, there will be people on earth who may not survive another day without food. And these needs have to be met. Now, whether or not God is going to miraculously produce food for them, I don't know. But if someone's starving and he won't make it through the night, somebody has to give him some food. The Bible doesn't tell us how this is going to be accomplished, but it has to be done unless God's prepared to let that person die or that individual. We could be directly involved, showing up, miraculously providing food for them until such time when they can fulfill that need. For example, he provided the Israelites with manna for 40 years. I mean, that may be a short-term solution to hunger at the time till, you know, it's like the story, you know, if you give a person a fish, you give him a meal for one day. But if you give him a fishing rod, you provide him a need, you know, the needs to feed himself for a long time. So, you know, there's that aspect to consider. Now, some may need immediate shelter in order to survive. Christ will be able to, he'll know the situation, so we'll be aware of that, and he'll direct us to deal with the issues that need to be dealt with immediately. Now, we know right from the onset that Christ will go and gather what's left of Israel, the nations of Israel, and bring them back to the promised land, to the land allocated to them as outlined in the book of Ezekiel. It's amazing. All these things, you know, the plans that have all been laid out, it's in the Bible. So if you'd like to turn to the book of Jeremiah, we'll cover some of the aspects of this. In Jeremiah 23, and in verse 3, beginning in verse 3, it says, "But I will gather the remnant of my flock out of all countries where I have driven them and bring them back to their folds, and they shall be fruitful and increase." Now notice, Israel is spread throughout all countries. They're not located in one area. They're just spread in various areas throughout the world. And yet he's going to bring them back, and they're going to be fruitful, and they're going to increase. And I will set up shepherds over them who will feed them, and they shall fear no more, nor be dismayed, nor shall they be lacking, says the Lord. Well, he's going to set up shepherds at it, not to beat them up, but to feed them spiritually. And there won't be any more fear. So they'll be able to grow in spirit when you remove that fear, and they won't be lacking anything. And they won't be dismayed. Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that I'll raise up to David a branch of righteousness. A king shall reign and prosper and execute judgment and righteousness in the earth. And this is talking about Christ, righteousness and justice in all the earth. In his days, Judah shall be saved, and Israel will dwell safely. Now, this is his name which he shall be called, the Lord our righteousness. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that they shall no longer say, as the Lord lives who brought up the children of Israel from the land of Egypt. That's a historical fact, but they're not going to be concentrating on that. But, in verse 8, as the Lord who brought up and led the descendants of the house of Israel from the north country and from all the countries where I had driven them, and they shall dwell in their own land. So they're not going to be talking about how Israel came out of Egypt. They're going to be talking how Christ brought them back to the land of Israel out of all these countries that they'd been dispersed through because of their sins. How long this will take? It doesn't really say. I mean, if they walk there, it might take a few years. I've heard in sermons in the past it could take a few years to get there. We don't know, but we know that they're going to settle in the land of Israel. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 11, and we'll read verses 11 and 12. In Isaiah 11 it says, "It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again, the second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left from Assyria." Now it starts naming them where they were: Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, and from Elam, and Shinar, from Hamath, and the islands of the sea. So they're even dispersed to some of the islands of the sea. "He will set up a banner for the nations and will assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." So here again, they were spread out throughout the four corners of the earth. But of course, Christ knows and will know exactly where they are, and so will we. Over in Amos, the book of Amos, it talks about this a little bit also, in Amos, the ninth chapter, and we'll read verses 14 and 15. Amos 9, and verse 14, "I will bring back the captives of my people, Israel. They shall build the waste cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink wine from them. They shall also make gardens and eat the fruit of them. And I will plant them in their land, and no longer shall they be pulled up from the land I have given them, says the Lord your God." So he's going to bring them back and plant them, and they're never going to ever go into captivity again. They're going to learn to serve God, and they're going to learn that that's their home. And it's, you know, that if you're always moving around, that's unstable. But this brings stability to the area. They know they're going to be there, protected and taken care of. The territory is outlined in the book of Ezekiel. I'd like to go there now, and it discusses how this is kind of laid out in the book of Ezekiel. Chapter 48, and beginning in verse 1, Ezekiel 48, in verse 1, it says, "Now these are the names of the tribes from the northern border along the road of Hethlon, at the entrance of Hamath to Hazar Enon, the border of Damascus northward in the direction of Hamath, there shall be one section for Dan, its east to west side. So right at the very top, you have the tribe of Dan. By the border of Dan from east to west, one section for Asher. And then verse 3, the border of Asher from east to west, one section for Naphtali. And in verse 4, by the border of Naphtali from east to west, one section for Manasseh. And in verse 5, by the border of Manasseh from east to west, one section for Ephraim. And by the border of Ephraim from east to west, one section for Reuben. And in verse 7, and by the border of Reuben from east to west, one section for Judah. So the French and the Jews are going to be bordering each other. Of course, they won't be at war, but it's ironic how they were laid out here. And by the border of Judah from east to west shall be the district which shall be set up, 25,000 cubits in width and length, and the same one for other portions from east, from the east side to the west, with the sanctuary in the center. So you have after you have these tribes in the middle there, you have that big section where the temple is going to be, and then it's sort of in the middle of, well, it's not really the middle, because you got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 tribes to the north of the city, and the rest are to the south. And if you drop down to verse 22, it says, moreover, apart from the possession of the Levites and the possession of the city, which are in the midst of what belongs to the place, an area between the border of Judah and the border of Benjamin, along belong to the prince. So there's going to be a section of land that belongs to David. And it says, as for the rest of the tribes from east to west, in verse 23 here, there shall be Benjamin shall have one section. And then it says, by the border of Simeon from east to west, Issachar shall have one section. By the border of Issachar from east to west, Zebulun shall have one section. And by the border of Zebulun from east to west, Gad shall have one section. And by the border of Gad on the south, towards the south, the border shall be from Tamar to the west of Meribah by Kadesh along the brooks of the great sea. And in verse 29, this is the land which you shall divide by lot as an inheritance among the tribes of Israel. These are their portions, says the Lord God. So I went on the internet, and I went to a site, and it actually, I got it here, it shows a diagram, and it shows all the tribes, how they're laid out, Dan, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Ephraim, Reuben, Judah, and then in the section is where they have the temple, then they have the other tribes below. But what's interesting is that they're not large plots of land. 25,000 cubits is only 7 miles, and the area is not large, you know. So it gives you an idea that there's been quite a decimation of the population of the nations of Israel, because you'd never get, you probably couldn't get a United States in that area. And the area, if you look at the top, is where Damascus is today, and you go down to the bottom of Gad, it's only about 200 miles from top to bottom, 200 miles. And from east to west, it's between 50 and 70 miles, because it's not, you know, perfectly rectangular. So it's not a large territory, which indicates very strongly that there's going to be a small percentage of these tribes that are left over to occupy that land. Now, once they get settled in there, and of course they have peace and harmony, they're obviously going to grow. I mean, you know, they're going to start having families. They don't have war anymore. And where they expand to, the Bible doesn't really tell us, and how fast they'll expand. But initially, that's where they're going to be. Now, the rest of mankind has to be dealt with as far as the needs, and the earth has to be cleaned up from all the pollution and destruction caused during the tribulation and the day of the Lord. And there has to be a coordinated effort, both in cleaning up the mess and rebuilding the current, you know, people that are alive dealing with that. We, coupled with that, you have to have an agricultural program in place to grow food to feed everyone and to raise cattle for meats and animals. I mean, burying the dead is going to be one of the top priorities, basically to prevent the, you know, the spread of disease. Would you like to go over to Revelation 19? I want to read something in Revelation 19. And we'll begin in verse 17. Revelation 19:17, it says, "Then I saw an angel standing in the sun and cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather together for the supper of the great God, that you may eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses and of those who sit on them, and the flesh of all people, free and slave, both small and great. And I saw the beasts, the kings of the earth, and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. Then the beast was captured, with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence, by which they deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone." And in verse 21, "And the rest were killed with the sword which proceeds from the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds of the air were filled with their flesh." Well, you just can't have millions of dead bodies laying around and just ignore it. They've got to be buried. The dead bodies spread diseases. I mean, there's a limit to what the birds of prey can eat. And also in Revelation 9, a few chapters over, I mean, just to give you an idea, in Revelation 9 and verse 18, it says, "By these three plagues, a third of mankind was killed, by the fire, the smoke, and the brimstone which came out of their mouths." So, you know, you're not dealing with just with hundreds of thousands of casualties. You're dealing with billions, which is, you know, such a enormous number. It's really hard to put your mind around. Now, some of these projects will ultimately take 700 years. I mean, could take up to several hundred years to do, because they're massive in what has to be done. I mean, we have to get food production up and housing so that we're all worshiping the same God. And we know that at first there's going to be some resistance. It's outlined in the book of Zechariah. It's not going to be a case where they're saying, "Oh, great, you know, the Lord is here. Let's go worship the Lord." That's not going to happen. I mean, look what it says in Zechariah 14. And in verse 16, we'll read verses 16 to 20. It says in Zechariah 14, "And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came up against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." So it talks about those that are left of the nations that survived. "And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them will be no rain." So you can see that there's initially some resistance. "We're not going to go up there and worship the God of the Jews." It's, you know what I mean? "We've hated these guys for centuries," some of these nations may say. "But they won't get no rain. If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter, and they shall have no rain. And not only that, they shall receive the plague from which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." It's not just rain, and all of a sudden they're going to start being plagued. Well, wait a minute. Maybe there's a connection here between obeying and going up and not. "This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." So the indication is it's not just Egypt, but there's some nations around the world that will resist coming up. But it also says, "In that day, holiness to the Lord shall be engraved on the bells of the horses, and the pots of the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar." So eventually things will come around. Eventually, everyone will come to realize that blessings are associated with obedience to God's laws and the keeping of the Sabbath and the holy days, and failure to keep them will bring curses. A person has to be willing to be subject to God. Forcing someone at gunpoint just doesn't work. It's got to be from the heart. Since, you could scare people into obedience, but that doesn't work. It's got to be from the heart, and a sincere heart. Over in Isaiah 61 and verse 4, Isaiah 61 and verse 4, here again it talks again about, and they shall rebuild the old ruins, they shall raise up the former desolations, and they shall repair the ruined cities, the desolations of many generations. When you consider this, it's an enormous task in view of the fact that the cities have all been laid waste, and they will not rebuild the cities in the former layout. You won't have huge skyscrapers, and in slum housing. That's going to be a thing of the past. Look what it says in Isaiah chapter 5 in this regard. Isaiah 5 and verse 8. Isaiah 5, verse 8. It says, "Woe to those who build, who join house to house. They add field to field till there is no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land." So you could see that high-rise apartments and condensed housing, it creates too many problems in this age, and it's not going to be allowed. Now, I find it interesting that Christ was referred to as a teacher. That's one of the things that he was referred to. And you can go to John in the third chapter. And in John 3, and in verse 2, Nicodemus came to Christ, and this is what he says. I'll be there in a sec here. John 3 and verse 2, it says, "This man came to Jesus by night and said to him, 'Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him.'" So there was a recognition by the scribes and Pharisees at the time that Christ was a teacher. And also, in Mark, another aspect of what Christ was, over in Mark 6, in verse 3, Mark 6 and verse 3, it says, "Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James and Joseph, Judas and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us?" So they were offended at him. So we see that Christ was a teacher and a carpenter. Now, I find that interesting because we're going to be kings and priests, right? But he taught, and one of his titles is, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, but he's also a high priest, and he's a king. But he picked carpentry as his trade, and a lot of what we have to do in the millennium is to rebuild the way cities involves building, right? Well, he's got the experience. You know what I mean? Like, if he'd have picked any other trade, how could he? He will direct us how to build things because he knows how. That's what he did, using the proper materials, And he'll direct us how to rebuild things and according to what Christ wants. A balance between housing and parks, between manufacturing and farming, which will all be required. just because Christ is here doesn't mean you suddenly have no need for clothing or food. These things will still be required. And the one thing about it, you won't have manufacturing producing things that only apply to vanity. Today, a lot of sales are driven by vanity. You don't really need it, but you know, appeal to your vanity, so you figure, well, my neighbor's got one of those gadgets, I'm going to get one too. Well, that'll be all gone. They're only going to produce things that are useful. I mean, let's just say you had the responsibility of, just look at the city of London, for example. I mean, London, underneath London, I mean, you know, they got the underground trains and that, and they're at different levels. I mean, you're on the bottom level, it takes you forever to get up to the street, you've got to go up all these stairs. I mean, when these cities fall, those things are going to be just crashed. There could be a lot of, you know, dead people underneath there. Well, you just can't, you know, oh, well, just push dirt over it and then build on top. You got to, these people deserve a decent burial. So, I mean, it could be, I mean, where you start at one end and just start cleaning up, I mean, recycling things. I mean, look at how long it took to the Twin Towers, how long it took to clean that up. I mean, there was a lot of metal there and all that furniture. But, I mean, you got a whole city to deal with. How long is it going to take? Could take a long time. But the thing is, you could start at one end and start cleaning up and building at the same time, so that you got a process of cleanup and building, so that you can start occupying those buildings and then build up your manufacturing and then work that manner, you know. And of course, the oceans, they have to be healed, because, and the fish restored by the waters flowing out of them, which will be coming from Jerusalem. I mean, there's a lot of pollution. I mean, at one point in Revelation, it says a third of the ships were destroyed. You just can't leave them in the bottom of the ocean. Some of these are nuclear-powered submarines, and they create a hazard. So they've got to be cleaned up and dealt with, too. Now, let's go over to Ezekiel 47. It talks a little bit about this, which I find it interesting. In Ezekiel 47, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Then he brought me back to the door of the temple, and there was water flowing out from the threshold of the temple towards the east." So the water was flowing eastward, and the water was flowing from under the right side of the temple, south of the altar. And then in verse 2 it says, "It brought me out by way of the north gate and led me around the outside of the outer gate, which faces east, and there was water running out of the right side." So what he did, he went north. In other words, he went this way and he come around the side, and this is east, and the water was coming out this direction. And in verse 3 it says, "And when the man went out on the east with a line in his hand, he measured 1,000 cubits, and he brought me through the water, and it came up to my ankles." So it just initially it flowed out, and it was only ankle deep. "Then he measured 1,000, and he brought me through the waters, and it came up to my knees." So it was gaining, you know, in volume quite a bit. "And again he measured 1,000 and brought me through the water, and it came up to my waist." And in verse 5, "And again he measured 1,000, and it was a river that no one could cross, for the water was too deep, the water which one must swim in, a river that could not be crossed." So it didn't take long where, you know, it started a little trickle out of the altar, and next thing you know, you got a river, you got to use a boat to get across. "And he said to me, 'Son of man, have you seen this?' Then he brought me and returned me to the bank of the river." And in verse 7, "When I returned there along the bank of the river, there were very many trees. There were very many trees on one side and the other. Then he said to me, 'This water flows towards the eastern region, and it goes down into the valley and enters the sea. When it reaches the sea, its waters are healed. And it shall be that every living thing that moves whereas the rivers go will live, and there will be a great multitude of fish because these waters go there, for they will be healed, and everything will live where the river goes." And this is necessary. the healing of the waters and that, because of what happened previously, prior to Christ's return, during the day of the Lord, and that's outlined in Revelation 16. In Revelation 16 and verse 3, Revelation 16:3 says, "Then the second angel poured out his bowl on the sea, and it became blood as a dead man, and every living creature in the sea died." So you had total death of everything in the sea, and you have these living waters coming down, and they're cleaning up the blood, making it pristine, and also on its flow, it's creating fish, it's recreating the animals of the sea that were dead. So when they call them living waters, that's a good description, because they're bringing life back to those animals and sea creatures that were killed during the day of the Lord. And that's going to take time. I mean, but it's interesting, because that's not normal. You know what I mean? Like, to go 1,000 feet, so the waters are, they're almost like they're growing in volume and depth as you go away from it. And, you know, normally you have a little stream, it just doesn't do that. So you could see it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And as it gets into the Mediterranean and spreads out throughout the whole earth, it'll clean all that up. I mean, it's just going to be such a blessing to have pristine, clean water. You know, you catch a fish in there, and it's not full of pollution and lead and all the stuff that we got in there. Today, I mean, it's horrendous, the heavy metals and the pollutions that are in the oceans. So it purifies the water, makes them habitable for fish and sea creatures. But the shipwrecks at the bottom, which potentially could pollute, they have to be dealt with. And there are some things that God will intervene miraculously, but there are some things that we have to do. I mean, otherwise mankind's not going to learn. If God just waved a magic wand and all the ships would be, off the bottom and repaired, mankind wouldn't learn nothing. I mean, it's like if a child, messes up his room, and you say, "Oh, don't worry about it," and you go clean it up for him. What has the child learned? Well, he's learned that mom and dad will take care of my mess. I mean, Christ is going to say, "You made the mess. You're going to have to clean it up." Now, when man's mind, I mean, we could put man on the moon and build a lot of stuff we don't really need, but when their minds are directed towards fixing things, I mean, it'll be leaps and bounds. Some of these issues we'll be able to overcome and fix and correct. And some of them, probably faster than what maybe we had anticipated. So my second point is describing conditions in the millennium. I'd like to turn to Isaiah, second chapter. And we'll read verses 1 to 4. Isaiah 2 and verse 1, it says, "The word that Isaiah the son of Amos saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem." And in verse 2, "Now it came to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow into it." So it's not just established in Jerusalem, but it's exalted. "Many people shall come and say, 'Come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us of his ways. We shall walk in his paths, for out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem.'" What are the Iranians saying today? "Let's kill every Jew." You know what I mean? So the mindset is going to be totally changed by this time. "And he shall judge between nations and rebuke many people." Now, the rebuking, you only rebuke and correct a child to change the direction he's going. Once that directional, path is found, you could stop rebuking people, because they've learned the lesson, and then they can get the benefits. It says, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." I mean, you have these little children in ISIS. I mean, they're just how innocent we walk. You know, brings tears to your eyes to see these little kids in the church sing, and yet those little children in ISIS are given guns, and, you know, this is how you behead someone, and, you know, we've got to kill. I mean, that's, they learn that. You don't drive that out of them overnight, but they got to learn that, hey, listen, this is not the way to go. We're not having wars anymore. We're going to remove the ability for you to have wars. We'll get rid of the tanks. We'll get rid of the warships. We'll get rid of the planes. We can use those things to build tractors, to build plowshares for useful things. You know, guns and that will be a thing of the past, which will really be nice. I mean, I don't know. There may be some for hunting, but certainly you don't have to go hunting with a tank. You know what I mean? Or F-15. That's just, those things are going to be gone. People will go to Jerusalem and they'll be taught God's ways. And the rebuke is only for those who fail to obey, because once they start obeying, then they'll realize there's blessings come out of that. Yeah. The hatred of the Jews will dissipate too. And it may take a while. I mean, obviously, that, if something is ingrained all your life and you're an adult alive at the return of Christ and, you know, you're one of these Arab nations that's hated the Jews, you know, just because Christ has showed up doesn't mean you're going to wake up the following day and say, oh, I love the Jews. That's not going to happen. You're going to be, you learn to love things and you learn not to have war. I mean, these things are learned. And it's amazing what you can do if you have the rod in one hand and the hug in the other. You know what I mean? And even disciplining your children, you do it in love in a proper way. And you know, they respond to that. And God says, I'm going to rule them with a rod of iron. That doesn't mean he's going to go around wailing on them on a continual basis because he enjoys that. No, you only discipline to the, once you reach the goal, change of direction, change of heart, then you stop disciplining. And then, of course, that individual starts reaping the benefits, the blessings of obedience. Over in Micah, the fourth chapter, in Micah 4, in verse 1, it says, now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and people will flow into it. I like the terminology here, like they'll flow into it, just like, you know, the waters coming out of Jerusalem, they flow outward, and people will flow into there. And many nations will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord. So here we're talking about the many nations. They're willing to go up to the house of the Lord of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. We shall keep the commandments. We shall keep the Sabbath. We shall keep the holy days. We shall tithe. We shall keep the statutes and judgments because they bring us benefits. I mean, you know, if you're being cursed, you hit your head against the wall, and boy, that hurts, but it sure feels good when I stop. I mean, you know, people are going to learn. Some people are awful stubborn and might take a little more, you know, to get them to come around, but eventually they'll come around. Fortunately, I mean, the majority indicates by the Bible, for out of Zion the law shall go forth and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge between many peoples and rebuke strong nations afar off. Now, that's basically at the beginning, the rebuking in that. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Well, you take away all their tanks and all their guns and everything, and they say, well, what are we going to do now? I mean, you know, we can't go to war, so maybe we better talk about peace and look at something else other than what we've been doing, because it's not been too successful, you know. When they realize, you know, Christ could say to them, if I wouldn't have stopped this madness, you wouldn't be alive today. And when that realization permeates all the minds of people on earth, they're going to maybe appreciate the fact that Christ did intervene a little bit more, you know, when they realize, wow, you know, we wouldn't be alive today if he wouldn't have returned. over in Jeremiah 50 and verse 5. Here's a change of attitude. It says, "They shall ask the way to Zion with their faces toward it, saying, 'Come, let us join ourselves to the Lord in a perpetual covenant that will not be forgotten.'" Isn't that interesting and inspiring when you think that? Their whole attitude at this point in time is, "Hey, let's go up to Jerusalem in a perpetual covenant." In other words, something that we can do all the time and we won't forget about it. I mean, right now, people have forgotten God's laws. They just reject it. They don't want to have nothing to do with it. And the attitude of the people will be changed compared to the hostility that you have today. I'd like to go over to Isaiah 29. Isaiah 29. And I'll read verses 17 to 19. It says, "Is it not yet a little while till Lebanon shall be turned into a fruitful field? And the fruitful field shall be esteemed a forest." So you can see it's growing here. It's growing. It's becoming larger and larger. And verse 18, "In that day the deaf shall hear the words of the book," talking about the Bible, "and the eyes of the blind shall see out of obscurity and out of darkness, and the humble shall also increase their joy in the Lord." So you can have physical blindness and spiritual blindness, but both will be removed, which will be really great, because, I mean, not to be able to see physically is a handicap, but not to be able to see spiritually is a greater handicap. And both those handicaps will be removed. They'll see it in their mind's eye. And over in Isaiah 30, just a page over in my Bible, beginning in verse 19, it says, "For people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. They shall weep no more. He will be gracious to you at the sound of your cry." So if there are tears, you know, Christ will be merciful towards them. "When he hears it, he will answer you. And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore. We'll be there for them, help them, instruct them. We're not going to be hidden anymore. We're not going to be in the closet. We'll be involved in their lives. But your eyes shall see your teachers, your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, 'This is the way, walk you in it,' whenever you turn to the right or whenever you turn to the left." So when they are veering a little bit off the course, we'll be able to say, no. That's the path of death. You want to go to the path of righteousness. Don't go that way. The world has proven through 6,000 years of history where that leads. You go this way, it leads to righteousness, to eternal life. And over in Isaiah 11 gives us a nice picture of some of the conditions in the world tomorrow during the millennium. In Isaiah 11, verses 6 to 9, it says, "The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down together with the young goat, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them." One of these little children that was here in the choir will be able to lead them along. "The cow and the bear shall graze, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play in the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den." In other words, they'll be able to go and put their hand near a poisonous snake without being worried of being bitten. "They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." Now this is so inspiring to read, you know, when the knowledge that we have today, and sometimes we take it for granted, The majority of the world doesn't have that today. There's only a small few. And out of that small few, some of us are going to be protected, you know, from the tribulation and preserved so that there'll be a small remnant. But as God beings, which is our potential, this knowledge will fill the whole earth as waters cover the sea. And it'll be a tremendous time. Animals will no longer be hostile to one another or to man. And when we first got here, we got here on Friday, so we had a bit of a little Bible study on Saturday, and we discussed this aspect. And I was saying, well, it's interesting because something has to change, because right now there's a balance in nature, and you know, without that balance, things are going to go a little bit off the tracks. But like I was talking about a bear, you know, a bear can eat meat, but it can also eat berries and that. So that exists now. So a lion has to change his eating habits, obviously, but God has to do that, you know, and there has to be a balance maintained. We're watching a documentary on nature, but this was up north in BC, and there's a, you know how the fish, they go spawning every year, and they go up these waterfalls, and there's a bear sitting about halfway, and he's got his mouth open. The salmon goes right into his mouth. I mean, he didn't even have to make an effort. Here's your meal coming, right in your mouth. And I just laughed when I saw that. But they eat a lot of salmon, but it could be turned around where they just eat straw, and according to this. And I mean, I don't know how God's going to do it, because I was thinking, man alive, I mean, if my cat, which I don't have, if my cat doesn't eat the mice around the chicken coop, it's going to be run over by mice. But I mean, I don't think that'd be that difficult for God to do. He can adjust their productive, you know, way they produce. Otherwise, you'd be overrun by mice and rabbits and things that multiply a lot. But I mean, that's what's going to happen. And it's going to be great because, you know, where's little Johnny? Oh, he's outside playing with his 800-pound gorilla and the lion's in the bedroom, you know. It's something, it's almost like a science fiction movie that you're thinking of when you see this, but yet God says that's what's going to happen. And it's really going to be great. I mean, I think every child would like to go and pet a lion. I know that years ago in Disneyland, they used to have an old lion there, and I got a picture at home with my kids petting it, you know. And he was quite tame. And, you know, I got by quite good without my hand for a while. But anyway, it's going to be common. Animals won't be killing one another. We still need scavengers, because animals are going to die, and you just can't leave a dead animal around. You get diseases and that, but vultures and that could take care of that, but they're not going to be attacking people or attacking one another, which is going to be a tremendous environment. Over in Hosea 2, God talks about this, what he's going to do in Hosea, the second chapter, and verse 18. Hosea 2 and verse 18, he says, "In that day I will make a covenant with them, with the beasts of the field, with the birds of the air, and with creeping things of the ground, bow and sword of battle I will shatter from the earth to make them lie down safely." So he's going to make a covenant with the beasts of the field and the birds of the air so that they will live in harmony. I mean, there's going to be harmony eventually with mankind. We're not going to be killing each other and at each other's throats. Why would you have it in the animal world, you know, that type of aggression in that? So there's going to be peace and harmony with mankind, peace and harmony with the animals. It'll be a tremendous, tremendous environment. I mean, I can't wait. There will be peace in Jerusalem. It's not like today we have constant threat of bombs and killing of innocent people. This is what it'll be like over in Zechariah chapter 8. In Zechariah 8, and verse 4, and this is a beautiful picture that it's pictured here. It says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, O men, an old woman shall again sit in the streets of Jerusalem. I mean, today in Jerusalem, there's some quarters you can't even go in. It's just dangerous. It's, you know, bombing in restaurants, and you're always, you know, afraid for your life. Each one with a staff in his hand because of a great age. In other words, they lived to be an old age, and you could just see them with their staff in their hand. And the street shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets. Now, that is something to behold. Playing in the streets without fear of being bombed, without fear of being killed, and old men just watching this and bringing joy to their old hearts, watching the children play in safety. Christ, over in Revelation 19, I mentioned this before, but I want to go to the scripture. In Revelation 19, and verse 16. Revelation 19:16, it says, "And he has a robe on his thigh and a raiment, and his name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords." So we know that Christ is a great king. And also, and over in Hebrews 5, the king part is like the rulership part. He's got another very, very important function, and that is in Hebrews 5 and verse 5, it says, "So also Christ did not glorify himself to become a high priest, but it was he who said of him, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you.'" And in verse 7, it also says in another place, "You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek." So Christ is both king and high priest. Those are positions and titles that he has. And what is it that we're going to be? Over in Revelation 5, which we've read earlier on the feast, but doesn't hurt to read it again. In Revelation 5, and verse 10, it says, "And have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth." So we are going to be kings. I mean, Christ's title is King of Kings. We're the small kings under him. And priests also. The responsibility of bringing the knowledge of the Bible, the Word of God, to the people on the earth so that it can eventually qualify to become sons of God. And the earth will eventually be filled with the knowledge of God. And we will facilitate that. And eventually, we'll all talk the same language, which is going to be French, of course. I hope you realize that. But over in Zephaniah, the third chapter, it mentions that. Zephaniah 3 and verse 9, it says, "For then I will restore to the peoples a pure language, that they all may call upon the Lord to serve him with one accord." Now, it's important because of this. When you have all these languages, there's always a breakdown in communication. Like, French uses more words to express a thought than English, and some languages are like that. But when we're all speaking the same language, you can't say, "Well, there was a breakdown in communication. I didn't really understand him." That excuse will be gone. And look at how advanced and how speedily mankind advanced when they were building the Tower of Babel, right? They all spoke one language. You could advance so much faster in all areas of life, to the point where God had to come down and confuse the language, because he had to slow them down, because, you know, we'd have reached the space age way sooner than the 20th century if he wouldn't have sort of put the brakes on. But he's going to remove that barrier, and we're going to speak one language. Now, whether he's going to instantaneously put it in humankind, it doesn't say. But when Adam and Eve were created, they were adults, and they had a language already programmed in their brains, and they could speak it. I don't know what that language was, but it's, to me, it's no big deal if Christ instantaneously reprogrammed every human being so that they could speak that one language, so that there's instant communication, there's no doubt about it. When you say no, it means no. I mean, you know, some people say, well, no means yes. So that confusion and that will be totally removed. And think of the advancements we could make in positive ways. You know, when we're all speaking one language and all going in the same direction, I mean, mankind's potential is just fantastic. I mean, to the point where you're eventually going to be a God being, and then the fun starts. But it's just great. The problems of this earth, you know, the ones that we have to deal with, they got to be dealt with. But they'll be, once we're all on the same page, going in the same direction, they'll be resolved a lot faster. A lot faster. They won't be driven, you know, manufacturing, like I mentioned, won't be driven by greed, but by need. Not by greed, by need. And it'll be, make a big difference. And quality products, I mean, now it's built-in obsolescence. They build things to break down, so you buy another one. And they keep changing technology. You buy a computer, and a week later, it's obsolete almost. I mean, you know, and that's driven by, you know, further sales and greed. That'll be, when something is built, it'll be built to last. I mean, some of these homes have to last 1,000 years. I mean, they're not going to use cardboard to build a house in the millennium. It's got to last 1,000 years. People are going to be using them for that long. Let's look at Amos, the book of Amos in the 9th chapter. A picture of what it will be like in the world tomorrow. And during the millennium, in Amos 9 and verse 13, it says, "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the reaper of grapes him who sows seeds. The mountain shall drip with sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it." I mean, this is describing ideal conditions where the soil is rich and pollution-free, and you get rain in due season. I mean, you know, it's like you could hardly keep up. I mean, when the Israelites went into the promised land, I mean, they came out with a cluster of grapes. They had to carry it between two men on a pole. I mean, do we have grapes like that today? No, they're about, you know, 6 inches in diameter. But, I mean, imagine grapes the size of oranges. What type of wine that'll make for those that like to make wine. It'd just be incredible. This describes really good conditions. We can see that through time, the earth and the air and the oceans will be cleaned up to the point where these conditions exist, mentioned in Isaiah 25. In Isaiah 25, it sort of gives us a little picture of what it will be like. It says, Isaiah 25 and verse 6, "And in this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all people a feast of choice pieces, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of well-refined wines and lees." This sounds like the Feast of Tabernacles, right? You know, where you can have good food and good wine and just enjoy one another. The millennium will be exciting times of teaching people God's ways, rebuilding and refurbishing the earth. And my third point, which what needs to be done by the end of the millennium, well, one of the major tasks which we have to accomplish, and it's just not told us when this task is to begin, but you have to look to the fact that there are some 20 billion people or more are going to come up in the White Throne Judgment period, and they're resurrected to a physical existence. And they will need to be, I mean, we were jokingly saying, well, are they going to come up fully clothed or, you know, or naked? I mean, you know, somebody has been cremated. God's going to resurrect that person, but whether or not they're clothed or not, they're going to need food, they're going to need clothes, they're going to need housing. And all these clothing, housing, those physical needs have to be prepared during the millennium period. It's not going to be, when they come up, what's the first thing they're going to say? Probably, "I'm hungry. Oh, where's my clothes?" I mean, those basic needs are still going to be fulfilled in that large group of people. And we're going to have the responsibility as kings and priests to direct projects to bring it up to speed so that there's housing for all these people. Food production has to be brought up so that they can be all fed, because they have to be given an opportunity to become part of the God family too. And they have to unlearn error, which, you know, sometimes it's harder to unlearn error than to be taught new truth, which means they're going to need Bibles and writing materials and pens, and all these things have to be manufactured ahead of time so that they can have an opportunity to become members of the God family. And over in Revelation 20, talks about this in Revelation 20. In verse 5, it says, and the rest of the dead live not until the 1,000 years are finished. This is the first resurrection. So the rest of the dead come up after. So getting ready for this event is challenging by the mere fact of the numbers we're dealing with, but we'll be up to the task and we'll be able to do it. The furnishings and food production, clothing and all that has to be prepared for them. And the right sizes too, which of course we will know at that time. You know, no point having a closet full of clothes for someone that's coming up in the resurrection and none of it fits. But these physical challenges will be met, and all to facilitate the process of teaching them God's laws. That's the whole reason you want to take this large group of people and make them comfortable and safe so that they can learn God's ways. And we know that there'll be resistance at first, but eventually they will come around and they will learn that obeying God brings great rewards and disobeying brings curses. So the millennium offers challenges at the beginning and during and near the end, but it will be rewarding for us involved because it's a teaching process for them and providing for their needs and looking at them as potential sons and gods, sons and daughters of gods that we will be at that time, and they will have that potential. And I don't think there's anything greater than when you teach someone and see them come along and then they get the reward at the end and you're there to see that. I mean, that's like, it was all worthwhile. It's like when you're raising kids and they do really well and you look at each other and you say, well, that was worthwhile, all the suffering you went through to raise these kids, you know. But that's the potential for everybody. Become members of the God family. So they'll be exciting as God works his plan out on this earth. It would really be exciting. So we have a great privilege to be a part of that plan. So that's until my next sermon, which is covering the next phase. That's what we have to look forward to.